From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 14th, 2015. And on this day, the Penobscot Nation battles with the state of Maine in a Portland courtroom over ancestral fishing rights and the boundaries of the tribe's reservation. Hundreds of new Maine laws go into effect tomorrow, among them one that limits the use of drones by law enforcement. And opponents of ballot question one, aimed at strengthening Maine's clean elections law, gear up to defeat the measure. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. More than 100 people filled a courtroom in the U.S. District Courthouse in Portland this morning to hear arguments in a lawsuit brought by the Penobscot Nation against the state. At issue are the boundaries of the Penobscot Nation's reservation and whether those boundaries extend to the main stem of the Penobscot River for the purpose of protecting ancestral fishing rights. Susan Sharon has more.
According to the state's version of events, the case arose after Penobscot Nation wardens began confronting non-tribal members at public boat launches and demanding payment for access permits to the main stem of the river. At the same time, several non-tribal members were also summoned to tribal court for alleged hunting violations. Tensions increased, especially after the tribe announced it had exclusive jurisdiction over the main stem. So in 2012, former Attorney General William Schneider issued an opinion that said the Penobscot Nation Reservation consists of the islands but not the waters. He also said the state has regulatory jurisdiction over fishing, hunting, and other recreational activities on the river. 8 days later, the Penobscot Nation filed suit.
We're focusing on where does our right to sustenance-based fish exist. That's it. Has nothing to do with ownership.
Kirk Francis is chief of the Penobscot Nation, who sat in on oral arguments in federal court. He says essentially what the state is arguing is that the river isn't part of the reservation boundary.
What you're seeing here is not just an argument over fishing, where fishing can take place and who can regulate that. You're seeing a territorial removal of the Penobscot people and a separation from their cultural identity, which is why we're here to begin with.
In a written statement released after the hearing, the Maine Attorney General's office said the Penobscots are asserting ownership and exclusive jurisdiction over 60 miles of the river. The Penobscot's lawsuit would create a two-tiered system on Maine's largest navigable river, potentially excluding non-tribal members from using the river, the state said, and that would be in violation of the state and federal Maine Indian Claims Settlement Acts of 1980. Sherry Mitchell, a member of the Penobscot Nation and an indigenous rights attorney who is not directly involved with the case, says the state's position that the tribe doesn't have any rights in the waterway is absurd.
They couldn't even, the state wouldn't even refer to the tribe as the Penobscot Nation. They kept referring to the tribe as the Indians. And I think that that was strategic because if you kept saying the Penobscot in relation to the Penobscot River, it weakens their position because it's obvious.
The tribe believes the reservation boundary goes bank to bank and includes the main stem. Chief Francis says it's a position that's backed up by the Department of Interior and Congress. The state argues that the plain language of the Settlement Acts limits the reservations to the islands in the river. To accept the Penobscot's argument would mean they own dams, boat launches, and other private property along the river between Old Town and Medway, the state said. Catherine Connors, an attorney representing municipal dischargers along the river, says the case could have broader implications for the permit process.
And for our folks, the issue is who's regulating us. And another regulator would just pin over the top these people who are working on very thin margins in the first place, more costs, more regulations, and that's not what was meant to happen under the Act.
Chief Francis says the tribe has no interest in interrupting any existing uses within the Penobscot River. Dozens of people turned out to show their support for the tribe in court. Doug Bowen is from Porter.
They've always been river people. They've always depended on the river, and they have rights to sustenance fishing. And that's being taken away by the state.
Chief Francis says the Penobscot Nation is thankful that other people also care about the issue. Judge George Singel gave no indication when he might have a decision in the case. For MPBN News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Tomorrow marks 90 days since the Maine legislative session came to an end, and that means that hundreds of new Maine laws will take effect Thursday. Among them is a new state law that places limits on the use of drones by law enforcement. Mal Leary has the story.
Like several other new laws now taking effect, the legislation requiring law enforcement agencies to get court permission to use a drone became law because Governor Paul LePage failed to veto them within the time set by the state constitution. A similar law failed to overcome LePage's veto pen last year. Law enforcement agencies have also opposed the measure, but say it won't be hard to enforce since drones aren't being used in investigations anyway. Sagadahoc County Sheriff Joel Mary is president of the Maine Sheriff's Association.
We've seen over the course of time changes in the law that will affect how we use other investigative tools around surveillance. This is nothing more than that, and I think it's something that we can work with.
Major Chris Groton of the Maine State Police testified against the legislation, arguing that policies are in place to cover the use of drones. Groton says he's not aware of any unmanned aerial vehicles being used in police investigations anywhere in the state.
We have no immediate plans to do this. At some point we may look into this and explore it and look at the potential use. I can tell you right now we have no immediate plans to do this, but certainly we see the potential for this.
But Groton says he can see circumstances in which a drone might be useful, such as in a hostage situation or armed standoff. But he says there are costs to acquiring drones and training troopers on how to use them. Omi Amarisingham, the advocacy director of the ACLU of Maine, says the group pushed for the legislation because a law is better than a policy.
Without this statute or any statute, it's really hard for us to know what's actually going on. And if law enforcement have not started using drones yet, I think it's smart to have policies and limits in place before they start.
Law enforcement agencies are concerned about another new piece of legislation, the so-called constitutional carry law that allows Maine residents 21 and over to carry concealed weapons without a permit.
I think the passage of this law was misguided.
Portland Police Chief Mike Sawchuk.
I think the very concept is ludicrous in my mind. I think that in this country we continue to go the wrong way around firearms legislation.
He says the new law puts both citizens and police in danger. There are a lot of other changes taking effect Thursday that generated controversy during the session. One new law puts the overdose revival medication naloxone in the hands of more healthcare professionals and of friends and family members of addicts. Another new law provides uninsured and underinsured low-income women access to preventative health services, such as cancer screenings, annual exams, pap tests, and birth control. And as of Thursday, Maine will ban the use of powdered alcohol and prohibit the use of e-cigarettes in some public places in which real cigarettes are banned, including restaurants, playgrounds, and beaches. For MPBN News, I'm Mal Leary.
And under another new law that goes into effect tomorrow, Maine residents who are at least 21 years old will be able to carry concealed weapons without a permit. The legislation passed with support from both sides of the political aisle, but Portland Police Chief Mike Sawchuk says it's a mistake. In a press conference today, he explained why. Patty White was there.
Around noon on Monday, Sawchuk says officers responded to a call at the Northgate Shopping Plaza about a male who threatened three individuals with a handgun. 58-year-old Peter Shepard was carrying a loaded .45 caliber handgun under his shirt. Parts of the gun were painted pink, which Sawchuk says was meant to make it look like a toy.
So Mr. Shepard was ultimately arrested for carrying a concealed weapon, and we brought his firearm back here to the station as evidence.
Sawchuk says had the incident happened just a few days later, police could only have told Shepard, who also stated he was carrying his gun to protect himself from police, to go home.
One of our options is off the table. So to think that Mr. Shepard, who's protecting himself from police officers, with his altered firearm to make it look like a toy. He's going to walk back across the parking lot of a busy shopping plaza to go home with that firearm is disturbing.
Soschuk says the law puts both law enforcement and citizens' lives in danger. Maine is now one of seven states with a constitutional carry law. For MPBN News, I'm Patty White.
In November, Maine voters will decide whether to strengthen the state's so-called clean elections law. As Election Day approaches, opponents are organizing to defeat ballot question one, which would increase the amount of money available to publicly funded candidates. Members of the group Mainers Against Welfare for Politicians say if question one is approved, it would expand the influence of wealthy out-of-staters on Maine's political process. But Question 1 supporters say that view is wrong. A.J. Higgins has more.
Joining the two conservative lawmakers at the press conference was Governor Paul LePage, who has repeatedly blasted the ballot effort to beef up the state's Clean Elections Fund.
This is the biggest scam on Maine people. This is truly, truly about getting the wealthy wealthier and the poor people dumb. Keep them dumb. Dumb them down. This is a scam.
Republican Representative Larry Lockman of Amherst also attacked the Question 1 proposal as welfare for politicians, citing the fact that it dramatically increases clean election spending caps for gubernatorial and legislative races. The law would also impose new disclosure requirements on donors and hand down harsher penalties on campaign finance law violators. But Lockman says it will really benefit personally wealthy politicians who don't need to rely on taxpayer dollars for their campaigns. And Lockman names names.
Question one will triple the pool of welfare dollars available to fabulously wealthy politicians like limousine liberal Justin Alfond. Alfond's state Senate campaign last year was paid for by Maine taxpayers. If we triple the welfare benefits, others just like him will step forward.
As a clean elections candidate, I guarantee to the voters of Portland that I'll be representing their interests and nobody else's.
Democratic Senator Justin Alfond of Portland, who did run as a public candidate, says the clean election system empowers everyday Mainers to run for office. Andrew Bossy, the executive director of Maine Citizens for Clean Elections, says his political action committee is campaigning for question one to counter exactly the type of distortions in Maine politics that he says are being advanced by LePage and Lockman.
What we saw today was, unfortunately, misleading of voters about what question one's about. Question one is about making sure we have a government that's accountable and works for everyday people, not one bought and paid for by wealthy contributors and lobbyists that want to have a foothold in our policymaking process.
If approved, the initiative would increase funding for the Clean Elections Fund from $2 million to $3 million per year, paid for by eliminating certain corporate tax breaks. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Across Maine's northern border, a Canadian judge has signed off on the $338 million settlement fund for families of the victims of the 2013 Lac Megantic oil train disaster. As Tom Porter reports, they're expected to begin getting payments soon.
The Quebec judge's decision means victims' families should start getting money by the end of the year, says Bob Keach, trustee for the bankrupt Montreal, Maine and Atlantic Railway, which operated the train. However, one of the companies named in the lawsuit, Canadian Pacific Railway, or CP, declined to participate in the settlement because it denies any responsibility. As a result, Keach says CP still faces a number of lawsuits related to the tragedy.
I have estimated they'll be sued in six different jurisdictions in two countries, and that will go forward, I expect, quite vigorously.
Keach says CP could find itself on the hook for tens, if not hundreds, of millions of dollars. A spokesman for Canadian Pacific declined to comment on any potential future litigation. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
An all-girl Roman Catholic high school in Portland is going to drop its religious affiliation in the new year. Catherine McCauley High School was founded in 1969 by the Sisters of Mercy. Officials announced Tuesday that it will become an independent school on July 1st. The head of the school, Catherine Woodson Barr, says the split with the church was amicable.
We love the sisters. They love us, and they're excited that we will continue their mission, even as our governance structure changes.
But Bishop Robert Dealey of the Diocese of Portland said in a statement that he's saddened by the move and regrets the loss of a school in the diocese. The announcement comes as the school explores a new partnership with the University of New England. 12 Catholic schools remain in the state. And when many of those girls grow up, they'll head for the workplace. When we talk about women in the workplace, we often focus on issues like confidence, balancing work and home life, and how women can advance in the male-dominated ranks of company leadership. But that discussion often doesn't apply to a much larger group, poor working women. That's according to Caroline Fredrickson, author of the new book, Under the Bus: How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She says it's more difficult and risky for these women to try to improve their work conditions. Fredrickson will be delivering the keynote address at the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security Friday in Augusta. She told Maine Things Considered host Nora Flaherty that many working women aren't protected in the workplace, in part because of the history of worker protections in the U.S.
Sort of the unfortunate history of the New Deal is that, President Roosevelt had to negotiate against some members of the Congress who were fiercely racist and primarily representing the South, really wanted to protect what remained of the plantation economy in the South. And that meant making sure that the workers who worked in the fields and in the houses were left out entirely of all of the protective laws, couldn't join unions, could not get a minimum wage or overtime pay, were left out originally from Social Security. And those effects are lingering today because we have done very little to address the groups that were carved out.
We hear a lot about leaning in, opting out. You say those sorts of things could be very dangerous for poor working women.
Well, for sure. Let me just say, opting out is not even a possibility for poor working women because they really can't rely on someone else's salary to pay the bills. They have to contribute, or they may be the sole breadwinner. So there's no staying home. They have to earn enough money to pay the rent and feed their kids. But leaning in, you know, it's in theory and for certain women, you know, it's useful as kind of a self-help idea, which is, you know, maybe women could speak up a little bit more, that we have some cultural barriers that sometimes we internalize. But for low-wage women, leaning in and going and asking your boss for a raise or a promotion or something can often be really dangerous. And, you know, there are many examples of women who have tried that and are not, are asked to walk out the door instead of given the raise that they were asking for.
What sort of recourse do women have in these cases?
Well, so for the women who are actually protected by the civil rights laws, and I say that because women who work in smaller businesses are not covered by those laws. But say even for the women who are covered, you have somebody like Betty Dukes who worked at Walmart, and she's the woman who asked for a raise and a promotion. She's an African-American woman. Instead, she was first demoted, had her pay cut, and then she was fired. Well, she brought a lawsuit, and it became a class action against Walmart, but the Supreme Court decided that the class action was not a permissible way for these workers to exercise their rights, and so they dismissed the case. Well, the problem is for low-wage workers is that each individual case is worth so little and lawyers cost so much that it's virtually impossible to enforce their rights. So, I mean, there's some, you know, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or the state civil rights commissions can be a place to go to raise the issues. But we really, unfortunately, have stacked the decks against these workers, providing them with very few protections. And when they do have protections, then we put a whole bunch of barriers in front of the courthouse door so that they can't actually enforce their rights.
So what are you proposing in terms of bettering these conditions? How does the conversation need to change?
Well, so, for example, I was really pleased to hear in last night's presidential debate that the candidates are talking seriously about paid family leave. There are a few states in this country, like California, that have moved forward and established programs that are not as dependent on an employee being in a certain kind of larger company or working a certain number of hours in the year before, but are actually like a social insurance program. And we need to start thinking about programs like that, not only for paid family leave, but also we need to have a child care system that is fully subsidized and robust, universal child care that would help all families, because middle-class families can't afford child care either. You know, and we need to have a livable basic wage well above what our minimum wage is now to make sure that workers who are working hard every day can actually bring home enough money to put food on the table and a roof, keep a roof over their own heads.
Caroline Fredrickson is author of the new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. She'll be delivering the keynote address at the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security on Friday in Augusta. Caroline, thanks for talking with me.
It was such a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to being in Maine.
That was Nora Flaherty talking with Caroline Fredrickson, author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Fredrickson will be speaking at the Maine Women's Summit on Economic Security in Augusta on Friday. And if you want to go leaf peeping, now's the time. Maine foliage has reached its peak color, says Gail Ross of the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Ross says that in most areas of the state, 75 to 100% of the leaves have turned red and gold. And the colder temperatures forecast for the weekend mean that those leaves won't stick around long.
They are probably going to start dropping after this weekend.
One area lagging a bit is the Down East Coast, where about half to 70% of the leaves have turned. And that's the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 14, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Mal Leary, A.J. Higgins, Patty White, Tom Porter, Jennifer Mitchell, Erwin Gratz, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to know what you think about the program. You can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.